met Greg Story back in 2013, I believe it was. We were doing a conference in Austin, Texas, and I spent the day with him going, and he took me around, showed me his office, showed me some co-working facilities, took us out to lunch. Just a genuinely great guy. And I don't think he's changed one bit since we first met in that sense. He's had a pretty strong career in the design and design leadership world, and he's somebody that I respect, and I was able to catch up with him, and it's been a long time since we talked, and man, it was a great conversation. We're both sort of reflecting on our careers and looking to what the next 10 to 15 to 20 years might be. If you're in that place yourself, this is a great one. This is a good conversation for you. So I hope you tune in and let us know what you think.
Welcome to the Warrior Mindset Podcast. We are your guide as you make your way through life, getting better 1% every day. We believe that life is lived and true victory won through adversity. Nothing easy is ever worth it. We believe in the warrior ethos and support those that choose to walk that path.
Well, Greg Story, we were just talking. It's been a very long time since we've spoken, and it's good to hear your voice again, man, and see your face.
Likewise. I missed you.
I followed your career through LinkedIn, and I don't want to get into what a cesspool LinkedIn has turned into, but
I'm kidding.
I just don't enjoy it, but I do have to use it once in a while. But so what have you been up to? What have you been up to the past 10 years?
10 years? Okay. Got a minute, everybody?
Yeah.
So about 10 years ago is when I stepped down from being an owner of Happy Cog,
right?
For a number of reasons. And I went through 6 months of interviews in a lot of really different, interesting places. But at the end, I wound up at IBM Design at right as it was kind of approaching the peak year of that program.
Yeah, that place was hot when you were there.
Dude, it was it was hard losing Happy Cog, but in hindsight of, you know, that allowed me to go to IBM Design in Austin, Texas. And that is an experience that of the thousands of people that work there, we all look back at that of being this, you know, golden age.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say of design, but just of our careers, and just like so many things were happening there that was just so much good, so like and fundamental, right? Mm-hmm. It was interesting having worked at and owned a small studio of 35 people, then going to a company of 350,000, right? And there's no crash course. Hey, let's try to get your head in the right place. It was like throw you in the pool. And you know, if you're really drowning, we'll come and help you, but otherwise, figure it out, you know,
otherwise, please do your job.
Yeah. And even figuring out that was like, there was no notebook. I kept waiting for like, here's the IBM manual of operations, you know?
Right.
Cause from the outside looking in, you think that, oh, surely if they got to that scale, they've got all this stuff figured out. And it's like, nope, no. They don't have any. So
what you're telling me, there's no difference between a company of 35 people and a company of 35,000 people other than overhead.
Yeah, overhead. And you've got more people, you know, up and down that you've got to, you know, work with, collaborate, sometimes get permission or beg forgiveness. And then just know that you're, you know, whatever you want to call it, you're up and down, right? That's happening in like 50,000 other places in the organization simultaneously, right? It's kind of like when the Matrix, when they go to get weapons,
right?
It's like the racks kind of, you know, funnel in, and all of a sudden it's like 1,000 racks, you know. And
oh my goodness,
it's kind of like that. It's so I worked there, and then I kind of progressively went down, was at USAA for a time. Again, at a really interesting period in the chief design office had been stood up, and I was one of the last folks hired, the last executive hired, and to be there in a 100-plus-year-old company that is trying to wrap its head around what design is, what it does, how it fits, And for that not to even, you know, work didn't take, not at least didn't take very well. And wow. then to jump to that from into Envision, just as it was going from a company of 500 to a company of 1,000 people and into the chaos of that didn't work. Like they grew way too fast. They didn't know what was going on. And
right.
I joined just as people were starting to notice that the boat's taking on water. Mm. Right. And then I went to go work for a former client and ran that company for about a year and got things in much, much, much better shape around the people, practices, and the place, you know, of the company. And then the last couple of years, I've been trying different things in the consulting and coaching and advising yeah. realm and just seeing like, okay, kind of looking back, it's like I've done all the things. And I had, you know, the last 10 years, I've had this very, I would call aggressive schedule of getting a taste for design programs, digital programs at all range of scale. Mm. I think the only thing I didn't do was e-commerce, but looking back, it's kind of like I feel like I've accomplished a lot. I've left a lot of people yeah. in a really good place, and I continue to do that today through a lot of coaching and mentoring, especially in the last year.
That's cool. The coaching and mentoring. I've been doing a bit of that myself, not in the realm that you're doing it, but in the, you know, like the fitness and personal mental hygiene
mm-hmm. yeah.
realm. So tell me, man, we were just talking about like hitting my birthday milestone. I'm about to be 50. I think you're 2 or 3 years ahead of me. Mm-hmm. What about that point in time makes us sort of take stock of what we've been doing? Because I'll tell you, I really haven't looked back a whole lot until recently, until like the past year or two. I've really been looking back at like, man, look at all the stuff that I've been a part of, you know? Mm-hmm. What is that? Is it just like midlife or?
I think it's midlife. I think you look at it, for me anyway, I look at it and think, okay, I need to be much more purposeful as much as I can. You know, I don't yeah. want to turn into that guy, but you look at it and say, like, I look at myself and I start looking at the careers of people like Julia Childs, people like Milton Glaser, and you know, these people that worked, you know, until they passed away or close, you know. And I look at I feel like life for me anyway, it kind of happens in 5-year chunks, 4 or 5 year chunks. Mm. Right. And it used to be that I'd work in a place for about 4 years and then bounce and, you know, move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years, that's been anywhere between 1 to 2 years. Like it's you know, more I feel the opportunities are kind of are there, and it's been easier to go try different things. But where I'm driving at is once you get to like say 50, then you look at this and say, okay, I've got 5 more times. Like so if you ever played Mario Kart, right, and you play a tournament or a championship, there's like 4 races, right?
Yep.
And so my godson loves Mario Kart, and he will ask, can I play Mario Kart? And he's come down to say, can I play 4 games of 4, which means he wants to do 4 champions.
Yeah.
So in that, I look at this and say, I've got, you know, 1 game of 5, or I've got 5 games, like whatever it is. If I look at life or work anyway, in like a 5-year chunk, I feel like I've got, well, now I'm working on 4.5, right? Mm-hmm. Where I can go in and actually do something meaningful. And at the same time, potentially even say, you know what? I've always wanted to start a bait shop. Not really, but you know, something different, completely different from what I've been doing.
It's so healthy and so refreshing to look at something completely outside of your professional vertical. You know what I mean?
Well, not only that, but you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting at IBM is that they encourage you to do at least a couple of years in the position you're in and then go sideways.
Oh, okay.
Go somewhere else completely different. And they, not only do they encourage it, they kind of, you know, reward it, they celebrate it.
Wow.
Because the company is so large that when you go into a new group of people, the exchange of ideas and information is so powerful. And so, you know, you think about designers, writers, like people that are in digital, imagine what happens if they go into agriculture or they go into education or they go into something completely different. Not to say that all of their knowledge is going to be transferable, but their ideas, but more importantly, their perspective, how they think about 100%. Problems and think about challenges are likely going to, you know, give that experience and the people around you a lift, right?
Yeah, I've got this guy working with, I really like him a lot, man. He's come on to do, you know, like contractor building some stuff, but he was not he's not like a homegrown, how do I say this? He's not like a professionally schooled developer, right? Like every developer we've ever worked with. He didn't come from college to do it. He like learned it on his own and he came from a completely different thing and he tried something and it didn't work. And so he's like, well, I'll do this because they say it makes money. You can make money being a developer. So he started doing that. The way he just comes at projects and the way he communicates with me, it's very refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
We've all worked with developers. I'm not going to poop on developers necessarily, but like it's a certain thing. And this guy is just so different. And I can understand if IBM understands that from a personal level, that says a lot about them actually embracing like design as a way of life almost.
Yeah, I mean, design has always been a part of IBM's history, and they reference that a lot in the past. But I feel like that's also how you build some resiliency in your this large company, this large organization.
I think so.
And even organism, right, is like go teach and at the same time go learn and then keep moving around, right?
That's huge.
Yeah,
I like that you just used the word resiliency. This show is a lot about building resiliency. A lot of folks that I coach, it's like where we start, you know. They usually reach out after something's happened, you know, they've lost a partner or like, you know, their business went under or, you know, some big life thing or whatever. And they're like, how do I get over this stuff? And resiliency is like one of the first places we go to. You don't just do what we've done. I mean, I think you and I have been in the industry probably about the same amount of time. I mean, I've been a designer building websites for, you know, 25 plus years. I mean, I remember our original conversation was about like how we used to do things 10 years ago. 10 years ago. It was really fun, but you don't do that without a certain level of resiliency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it a generational thing or is it something that you think about?
I don't think it's a generational thing. I think it's a matter of life experience and how much you've gone through.
Yeah.
Whether that was of your own decision making or not. And I would I would also say like the perspective shouldn't be how do I get over this, but it's more of like how do I get through it?
Ooh.
Right. Because if you're looking to just get over it, then to me that's a mindset where you don't want to learn from it. You just want to get it behind you and never think about it again. That to me is not ever going to build resiliency. That's just going to get you on to the next, right? Yeah. And if that's your, if that's how you're thinking about problems, then you're bound to repeat them, right? So, this, by the way, Brett Harnett and I, who's my friend and now business partner, we recorded a second season of Sprints and Milestones and put that out last year. And the whole focus was on failure.
Mm.
And it wasn't so much like, how did it happen? But more of like, what happened? How did you get through it? Right. Emotionally, sometimes physically, you know, mentally. And then what did you learn? Like after you got over that shock and got through that event, looking back, what did that teach you? And so I feel like that's the, you know, that's what builds up resiliency. Right. That's
I agree with you. Yeah. Wise words.
Because if you do that a couple of times, then you start to build. You start to recognize the patterns of whatever chaos of catastrophe of whatever that is and recognize, I can take a second to breathe here. Take inventory of like what's around me, what I need to do, prioritize like. there are some fundamental ways of thinking about those moments and how to respond and even how to prioritize both, right? And that to me is what builds or makes someone more resilient, is having to build their own like playbook for how they respond in the moment of that.
Right. You spoke about your business partner, Brett Harned, great dude. Your company, Same Team, which I love the branding and stuff on that. You're doing a lot of, you're doing business coaching and leadership coaching and stuff like that. How do you, is that a thing that you see where you recognize that someone sort of needs to work on this aspect of like, how do you catalog the shit you've been through to use later? You know,
I think so, because like, interesting that you say like kind of catalog the shit you've been through. Because you mentioned earlier about looking back, right? And I do feel like not enough people, you shouldn't live in the past, but you should take stock of what happened.
Yeah.
Right? For a number of reasons. One is, I think a lot of times we'll just get over something and then not look back and say, what, what the hell just happened there? Right. To know, again, to teach you like how to not get in that situation again, or how to respond better than you did. Right. But I also feel like if you look back and actually take stock of the things that happened, that took place, that you did, small to large, good or bad, to me, for me anyway, that makes time crawl. Right. I hear people talk about how, you know, oh my God, time just slips by. It just does. It's like, have you actually spent 5 to 10 minutes without distraction, just documenting, looking back and saying, you know, this is what I did in whatever that period of time is.
I love that.
And it's like right now I'm, my wife and I are in Southern California for a couple months in the winter to avoid the dark of the north. And, you know, we've been going to places 6 weeks at a time, and we're about to wrap up here in Palm Springs. And then you kind of look back and say like, wow, where'd the time go? And then it's like, nope, you can't say that, because if you think about all the things that we've done, you know, we did just to sit on the couch. We've been to Joshua Tree a couple of times. We've been stargazing. Incredible. We've done all this stuff. It's like, I'm kind of tired. I'm ready to move on.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But I feel like, going back to what you're talking about, coaching and especially business owners, if they're not doing that, if you're not doing this and you're listening, you really should take stock of all the stuff that you've done, all the things that you've been through, conquered, survived.
Yeah.
Right. Because I think it just helps build your character. If you, like, how do you build character if you don't do that?
I don't know how you don't. It seems like people get really caught up in the logistics of those sayings, you know, like you said, don't live in the past. It's like they take it. People I've found take it very literally. And it's like, well, that's not 100% what that means. It means don't dwell on it, but learn from it and enjoy it and write that shit down. Like you're saying, it seems like in our youth, we spend so much time just trying to get from point A to point B as fast as possible. And then maybe that's where we are in our lives. Now we're trying to like slow that process down.
Well,
slower every day.
For me, it's not slow it down. Although, I mean, you want to enjoy life, but I think it's more of like, all right, I've done this. And now for me, I'm able to be a little bit more selective on what to do next.
Yeah.
I'm very appreciative and privileged to be able to do that. But I mean, that's where I think a lot of people get to, is like, okay, now what? Right. And for some, like just doing what you're doing, that's cool. I honestly don't want to start a bait shop. I really do like design. I do like doing things, on the web, but you know, you just kind of you want to be open to some different ideas and different opportunities.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately too. I mean, I don't know how much straight up like client project management, client builds, and things that you're involved in with your own hands still. and I don't want to make assumptions, but like I still do a bit of that as well as managing teams. And I've just been thinking about like you mentioned, I don't want to misquote. Who's the designer you mentioned? Was it
Milton
Glaser?
Yep.
You know, all these, I'm looking at the IBM logo and I can't remember his name. The designer of that thing. Anyway.
Oh, Paul.
Paul Rand. Yeah.
Paul Rand. Mm-hmm.
Like these people that did what they do, up until like their 80s.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we're kind of lucky in what we do where we potentially can do that work. Like, you know, you're thinking about retirement, but like, I'm not even thinking about that in terms of what I do for a living. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I'm fully planning to continue to create and to think creatively until the end. Mm-hmm. And I think we're super lucky.
Well,
to be in that world.
Totally. That's where my mind is right now. Is yeah. I'm focused on what are some initiatives that I can be doing when I'm 80 years old, because yeah. I got to tell you, I'm here in Palm Springs. This place is retirement central.
Yeah,
you're right. And I just posted to Threads yesterday. I'm like, Palm Springs is there's two patterns of life here. You either playing golf, or you're waiting to die, right? And everything right. else is in support of those two life streams mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. And neither of which to me appeals to me whatsoever. Yeah. I've played enough golf to know I don't want to be doing that day in and day out. Mm-hmm. I don't want that to be the thing I wake up in the morning and say, like, what am I doing today? I'm going to go play freaking golf. I look at what people like Milton and again, like Julia Child. And it's like, I may not practice design this the way that I did when I was 25, 30, but I want to be in this world. And and I want to, and I do want to have my hands, you know, in it. Like I'm amazed how many design leaders there are out there that do not know how to use Figma. It scares them. I've talked to some, I've coached some of them, and you know, in this downturn where they look at this and say, I might have to be, just go back to being a designer. And that terrifies mm-hmm. them because they've got a good 2-3 maybe 5-6 year gap of actually having done the work.
Yeah.
And there's this fear of like, oh my God, it's a whole different world. And it's like, it is and it isn't. And like best practices and the way we do things, those will always continue to evolve, right? But I always want to have at least a toe in the, you know, the dew pool.
Yeah.
I agree. I don't ever want to be divorced from it.
Wow. You know, I don't even know how to parse that, but I have a lot of thoughts at one time. One is that you're one of people that I know that have been a design leader, the design mm-hmm. thinker for a long time in terms of, I mean, yours was one of the early blogs that I read. You know, I don't know. We could talk about your history into the digital realm, but I mean, I started as a print designer. Doing t-shirts, mm-hmm. doing old school, like, you know, and came up that way. And then it was, I don't know, 96, 97, somewhere in there, 95. I don't even remember, you know, the place I was working at was like, you know anything about websites? Can you build our website? And I just did that. And then it was like, at that point in time, once you built a website, everybody in town was like, oh, you can build websites? Come work for us, you know?
Yeah.
Like I said, yours is one of the, I think you were ahead of the game as far as I was concerned myself doing that, but yours is one of the first blogs I read, but your mindset is around that continual learning, that continual improvement, right?
Well, I mean,
it's like what you're made of. It's your DNA.
I think it is. And one is just naturally being, learning to just sit there and observe until you've got something worthwhile to say, right? And being curious, right? Of just like, how does this work? thankfully, my wife puts up with me, but I'll buy stuff just so I can play with it for a couple of minutes and just see like, how did it work?
Mm-hmm.
Right. then put it on Craigslist. But
yeah,
I'm always more curious about what's been built and how it works and how it operates.
Yeah.
It's sometimes more so than actually, you know, using the thing long term, you know, or playing a game or even like reading a book or like whatever. But No, I grew up where I grew up in the world where we didn't have GUI, right? We had,
Oh yeah.
And so like, you know, I remember using the first Macintosh 128K Macintosh.
Yeah.
We had like
green screen, baby. Yeah.
Swap disks, you know, for 20 minutes just to get Mac Paint to load. And then you draw something and it's like, now what, you know, because
they
didn't have printers back then. You know, so it's like, hey, family, come in and look at this. Like, whatever. But that's in school where we were still, you know, burning screens to be able to print stuff. And I've designed my fair share of t-shirts and cut my own Ruby Lith.
Oh, right? Man. No one listening to this is going to know what the hell we're talking about, Ruby Lith. But yeah.
I mean, this is... I think it's interesting because you then look at that and say, cutting Ruby Lith, you know, there are parallels to it in modern day tooling, but still there's some fundamental practices there that transfer, transfer no matter what you're doing or kind of how you're doing it, right? And I feel like that's... I've talked to many design leaders about the need for designers to actually learn the fundamentals over their tools. I had a thought the other day. So when I was a kid, one of my first jobs was bagging groceries. Right. And so the place that I worked at, Carr's Grocery in Alaska, the baggers is what we were called. Our job was to not only bag up the groceries, but we had to deliver them to the customer's car. Mm. Right? It wasn't an option unless the customer said no, go away. You took the groceries out to the car. That was like the level of service that we provided. And I was thinking the other day about how when I got started, my first day, I show up. I'm in my uniform, which was, you know, a tie and like a vest. And the manager said, okay, thanks for coming. We're going to have Brian show you around. And so they would take a guy in the middle of the day, in the middle of the shift, they would take a guy off the line. And then that guy just gave you a 2-hour tour around the store. I remember thinking like, this is boring. I want to go do the job. Like you're watching. And it's like, I don't need to know where all this stuff is. My job is up front, right? Yeah. For a lot of people, they took it as, oh, thank God, I can take a 2-hour break now and not do my job.
Yeah.
And so the consequence of that is that, you know, after years of working there, new people would come on. Then all of a sudden, you're down one person, actually two, and they're off futzing around for at least an hour, maybe two, while you got to go cover for them, right? And then by the time they get there, they're worthless. They haven't been told anything about how to bag groceries, right? It's just, it's kind of left to, this is the lowest type of work you could do. Put a thing in a bag and repeat until things are no longer coming down the belt. Well, it turns out there are fundamentals on that, right? You know, things like heavy at the bottom, light at the top, right? Don't put stuff on top of eggs. Don't put your bread at the bottom. And then, And some of this stuff should be common sense, but you would be amazed how many people come to that role and they don't think in that way. They're not thinking. They're just like automatons. And so one of the first things I did to kind of show initiative is I went to my manager and I said, hey, listen, I've been noticing a pattern that every time we hire new people, they come on and they do this and, you know, ultimately they're not given any kind of training. And so it takes them weeks to get up to speed to do a very simple task. I said, can I train the next batch of people? And she said, absolutely. So, so I got three people at a time. And what I had done is I gave them a tour to let them know like where things are in case they need to go do those things.
Yeah.
But then we went to one of the checkout stands and I had pre-selected enough groceries to fill two bags that kind of represented a good cross section of groceries, you know, produce, dry goods, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And then I told them we did have some sort of standard in that there used to be a bag off championship.
Yeah.
So this company had a contest and they would have the same ingredients and you had to bag those groceries as fast as you could. They had to weigh within 1 pound of each other. and they would cut down the sides, paper bags cut down the sides, and it needed to freestand as much as possible. And that's how they judged you against those three things.
Man.
Right. And so I took the same kind of thing, like, well, if that's the competition, let's do the same thing for training.
Right.
So I took near the same ingredients and I pretended to be the checker. I showed them how to do it first and what my thinking was. And then I had them each go through twice, bagging the stuff. And then we would take a look at it as a team and kind of give recommendations and then go through it again. Within an hour, those people knew what was important, what to do on how to perform their job. And they were instantly useful. Not the best, but they at least were, you know, we didn't have to wait weeks for them to get in line.
You're and not so, smashing bread. Yeah.
Thankfully, I had management that took notice. And within a couple months, I got a promotion. And you'll laugh at this. I got a $1.50 raise.
Yeah.
Which at the time was huge.
Yeah.
Like my friends at McDonald's were getting like 5 and 10 cent raises, right? And I got a $1.50.
That's a huge raise.
Yeah. But that's, I was thinking about this the other day about writing the two pieces here. One of like taking initiative. If you see something that's not working, you've got better ideas. Go try something, you know, don't ask for ownership. I didn't ask to own it. I just asked, can we try this thing? And then it worked. And the other thing though, too, is the need to have some fundamentals of, you know, what you can learn from tasks that you wouldn't associate with digital that are still can be transposed, you know, into being fundamentals of your vocation.
100%. Like, I mean, what started this was you're talking about some people that were scared of using a Figma, which for those listening is we use Photoshop historically to do what we do. And Figma is like a newish version.
Yeah. It's like the latest tool. Right.
And you know, some old schoolers haven't really picked it up yet. And,
but you know, you say old schoolers, I'm talking about people who are, let's call them grade schoolers.
Oh yeah. I got you. Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
So it doesn't mean you don't have to have white hair.
Right.
To be nodding at that statement.
Yeah, no white hair here, man.
I think it's again, how many design leaders think, oh, I'm a director now, or I'm whatever, and so I don't touch tools.
Yeah,
and to me, that's led to the problem that we had of like so many people getting laid off, and then a lot of the new jobs that are being posted, especially for leadership roles, are making a point of you will be doing some work as well, right? This is. You're not middle management exclusively. You have to actually deliver some work as well.
Yeah. What's the age old thing of like, you know, you're the person in the team and you're really good at what your team does. And so they take you out of doing the thing you're really good at.
Right.
And get you to do something you're maybe not good at that's brand new. It just doesn't make sense.
Or more importantly, they take you out. And again, they don't give you training.
Yeah. And then they're like, lead all these people. And you're like, I just know how to use Photoshop.
And they just make assumptions of, you know how to work with people, right? You know how to empathize, you know how to set goals, you know how to manage, you know how to listen to their problems and that have nothing to do with work and, you know, get them the support they need so they can do their work. Like it's classic. And that's why I look at the training thing that I talked about with the groceries. And it's like, that happens over and over and over and over and over again. I don't know why, as humans, we continue to make that mistake.
That is kind of fascinating. The other thing was that I was thinking when you were talking about Figma is that we had brought in someone who was younger, and I'm not just picking on younger people, but this is where new people come from usually. Mm-hmm. They were pretty fresh out of college, and we were using Photoshop, and I was like telling them, well, let's, you know, they were trying to, I forget what the hell we were doing, but I was like, use the little airbrush, you know, that'd get a cool effect on that, you know, trying to make like a background or something. And she looked at me and was like, what's an airbrush? And it made me like even just like the icons and things that are in that program, they represent old things like X-Acto knives and air. They represent like tactile things.
Save is as the disc, right?
And it's like there's a whole realm of people that don't even have a concept of what those icons like are representing. They know what it does when I use it, but they don't know the history behind what it's representing. And that kind of made me go down this rabbit hole of like, well, what is out there that I don't recognize that might be like future facing, you know, that I don't even understand. to kind of bake my noodle a little bit. But the point is that it's not the program, it's the fundamental skills that we have. Like whether I'm using Photoshop or Illustrator or Figma or Couscous or whatever new app is out there,
right?
I'm trying to solve the same problem that I'm trying to solve no matter what tool I'm using. Right. And I have to be able to know how to solve that problem.
Well, it's me that goes back to your theme of resiliency, right?
Yeah.
Of if you know fundamentals, then you can get that job done with an array of tools, yeah, array of methods, right?
Yeah.
I have to imagine that transcends into some of your karate jujitsu stuff of
100%.
A dive roll, you know, is a dive roll.
Yep.
One you may turn left or turn left, mm-hmm, right, you know, but at the same time, it's like run, jump, duck, you know.
Yep.
That's the same no matter what
you're practicing. What are we trying to do here? Yeah. Doesn't matter what I call it or what, you know, suit, right, I wear while we do it.
Right.
It's all the same. It is all the same.
Yep.
Man. So how do you go from, I do want to specifically, and what got me like thinking about even reaching out to you on LinkedIn is you posted about an article, and I know this might be shifting gears a little bit, but what was the name of it? Pull it up.
I think
here.
It was Established 2012 or something like
that. Yeah, that was the name of it, Established 2012. But you're telling a story in you know, you go in as much detail as you want or don't, whatever, but yeah, like of coming into Happy Cog, merging your companies, because you were essentially merging what you were doing with what they were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had my own studio, the Airbag Industries.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Zeldman told me, you know, use Airbag as your company name because that's how everybody knows you. So I did.
It's a great name, by the way.
And thank you. And I, at the same time, I was still helping Happy Cog out from time to time because Jeffrey's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
But there came a time, many years later, where Airbag had grown to a healthy size of about 10 employees. And we found ourselves competing with Happy Cog. We would show up to pitches, yeah, and they'd, right, be coming out the door and we would be in the lobby and yeah, vice versa. And after a while, I was like, you know, this sucks having to, because we're friends and, yeah, you know, to some, yeah, some part, it felt like family almost. And so it's like, this is lame. We should just work under a name, and Happy Cog's the bigger name. So let's just, you know, and so we worked it out, you know, where I kind of merged Airbag into Happy Cog and became, mm-hmm, a partner. And at the same time, Airbag was hybrid model before that was even a word, a thing. And Happy Cog was, primarily Philadelphia. And there were two very different
like
cultures.
Remote, like your people were not in the same space.
Yeah, I had people, yeah, even starting, like my first two employees back in 2005, 2006 were on the East Coast and I was in Orange, okay, County, California.
Right.
So we just had two very different cultures, and we'd operated as two separate companies. So like in full transparency, there was no, I didn't get paid for Airbag. Nobody paid me to acquire Airbag.
Right.
I just started working as, you know, Happy Cog DBA Airbag, yeah, Industries LLC. Right. So we were flying the same flag, but we were very much two separate operations. And then there came a point where that was kind of getting in the way as well,
mm,
because the way we handled it was the sales pipeline would, opportunities would kind of get funneled to the shop that needed it the most, the next, right? So we ran that way, and that worked until it just didn't make sense anymore. And we wanted to just become one company. So we did. Greg Hoy and I folded our operations together into like a single unified Happy Cog, but we were still running things different, and we still had two studios that had two very distinct different cultures. And it just, that kind of started to build until there was just animosity from one group to the next on who's getting what gigs.
Yeah, you're still competing. You know,
their fridge has more stuff in it than ours does.
Well, yeah, I get
you. It was really starting, yeah, to get into like the tit, yeah, for tat kind of,
yeah, yeah,
kind of shit. And but where it really got to a point was when we had leadership, and it was starting to that kind of tit for tat was encroaching on in our leadership conversations.
Yeah.
And at that point, I honestly thought that we were maybe a couple months away from just saying this was a great experiment. We tried it, but it's not working, right? And then Brett Harned came over to Austin. He was in Philadelphia. He came to Austin because we had centralized project management, thinking that that might help do it. It didn't. You know, it helped us centralize a practice, but it didn't really patch any of the problems.
Yeah.
But Brett was coming over to see, like, you know, what could be done and just kind of get a firsthand perspective of what's going on in Austin. What are people thinking, saying, feeling, you know, to, if anything, just to help inform his own thinking about how to solve the problem. And so he and I had a conversation, and then it was happy hour. So as you do in Austin, as I'm sure you do in Southern South Carolina, you'll get a beer.
Yeah.
And I think it was like two beers in when I was thinking, you know, like, hey, what would happen if all of a sudden, instead of it being the Philadelphia team and the Austin team, what would happen if all of a sudden the project teams were virtualized?
Yeah.
Right. You still, everybody comes to work, everybody comes into an office, but what would happen if we just had created virtual teams? And so Brett and I kind of on paper took stock of, here's how many designers we have. Here's so many, you know, senior designers, mm-hmm. designers, developers, engineers. And then we worked out like team size, and come to find out, we could create like four virtual teams and then have engineers and project management kind of float in between teams as needed. Mm. And I got this idea. I can't take full credit for it, but I got the idea from a company in Kansas City, Missouri, that I was interviewed to join as a designer back in 1999. And they had run their studio before there was ever like the Pods model.
Right.
Or spoken wheel or whatnot. These guys, yeah. they had teams of like a writer, a designer, and a developer, three person teams. And there were like six of them, and they each had their own name, and they would do the bulk of the work. And then there was a pod of engineers that would go in and do the big work in the behind scenes. Right. And then there was account managers, project managers, all that kind of stuff. Anyway,
okay.
We looked at doing something like similar with the people that we had. And on paper, it totally made sense. I didn't know what the outcome was going to be, but I figured if we start merging these people and mixing them together, then they're not going to be from Austin or from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
They're going to be from one team or the other, right? They're going to change their perspective.
Yeah.
And so I got our leadership team to buy in, and we launched this program, and we gave everybody kind of a, you know, go create your own Slack channel with only your team can be in that Slack channel. And within a week, all of the, like the tension was gone immediately, just evaporated. The teams completely adopted virtualization. They completely embraced Slack. They formed their own mini cultures. They had their own team names. And as I wrote in the article, some of them even made their own t-shirts. And they would show up at the company offsites wearing their team t-shirts, right? And it changed the company like pretty much overnight. And it made it so that we could now scale to whatever we wanted to because we had solved the problem between offices.
That's brilliant. It's the cars bagging training all over again.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, it's just thinking about it, you know, It's challenging ourselves to think about the problem differently. And in this case, the problem wasn't that one team had more than the other, because that was the perception. The problem is that we thought about ourselves as one location over the other, right? And so if you get rid of the locations, which is what that was the solution, problem solved.
That's, you know, so it makes me think a lot about, I mean, there's a ton of people, you in turn on the news at any point, there's a story about, you know, people being forced to go back to the office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it just seems like it's a, you know, an Instagram meme at this point. So what, I mean, what have you encountered? I mean, that's an older story. I mean, you wrote that, it's retrospective, but like, what have you encountered recently that's where you're maybe dealing with some of this stuff? Like people are remote, some aren't, some are like have animosity over the fact that some are remote and some aren't.
You know, I was thinking about this. It's a good question. I was thinking about this the other day, because I don't think it's an old story. I think we're still very much in the thick of it, because, you know, if you take a look at the CEO from Interbrand, you know, made that stupid hokey video about, you know, everyone's coming back in the workplace. This isn't a negotiation. It's going to happen. You know, you're going to like it or you're not.
Yeah.
But the what to me was, if you look at that video, if you haven't seen the video, you got to watch it, because they got some of the leadership to pitch like why this is important. Right. And every one of those leaders looks like they've been, you know, they were kept awake for 48 hours, you know, not fed anything. Yeah. They promised like food and a cigarette or something if they'll just read this line. It really does look like looks like prisoner of war kind of stuff. It's just, it's so bad.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about, you know, the one of the points that they tried to mention is that we're better together, and when we're together, we innovate better. And it's like, I unless there are some cases, I'm sure, like you get into manufacturing and you know, you're having to actually, you know, tactile stuff. But when you're remote, I'll challenge anybody. I'll go toe to toe that working in the same room creates better innovation. That's bogus.
Yeah.
You know, being supported, given the right amount of training, support, autonomy, focus, goals, like these are the things, you know, tools that makes it so that you're innovative, right? Giving people the idea and the space and the prompts, the permission to go be innovative and to listen to them. That's how you get innovation. Has nothing to do with how many inches are you from somebody? Zero. Yeah. But to me, the more important thing is if I'm a board member of these companies that are forcing people to return back to work because I don't know any different, right? That's what's happening, is these leaders are looking at this as a challenge to their authority.
And they're scared, right?
And they're scared because they don't have any other model, or they're not, they're assholes. They're not willing to consider other
models. I immediately thought of Elon Musk.
Yeah.
When he was like, you need to be back. I forget what his quote was, but it was pretty empathy less, whatever his quote was.
Let's talk about that jackass for a minute, because, you know, I remember Elon, there was an interview with him where he talks about, you know, being a leader is tough because, you know, when you're on top, everybody just brings all of their problems to you, you know, and all your day is just solving problems and dealing with bad people. And it's like, that's only if you don't give people the responsibility, the autonomy, the authority, but also hold them accountable for making those decisions on their own. If you set up your leadership team and if you ran a positive environment for leaders to be leaders, no one's going to bring any problems to you whatsoever, right? They're actually going to be afraid to bring problems to you because it's going to make them look incompetent that they couldn't make a decision, right? So then at that case, it's like if they're bringing something to you, it's a pretty big problem, right? And that's just that whole mindset of like, oh, being a leader is tough. It's being tough because you're really shitty at it, right?
Well, it seems like it's almost half of that and half of just having empathy for other people. Like I was looking at an article on Inc.com, and like the number one's obviously like flexibility and time with my family. But the number two reason for wanting to work remote was the bathroom. Like they just didn't want to share a bathroom with people they didn't know that well.
Yeah.
It just seems like it comes down to basic empathy things. And you were talking through that. And I'm like, you know what's funny? It seems like those same rules about giving someone autonomy and trust, but yet holding them accountable, those are the same rules that we should have relationships with other people with, right?
This is why you have programs like EOS, right? Where people find it hard for me to say, Gene, you signed up to do this thing.
Yeah.
It, by this time or whatever, it's not done. Like, what's going on? Right. And, mm-hmm. and if it's, you know, let's say it's on you,
yeah,
I got to hold you accountable. And I don't know right. what the consequences are in this situation, but I mean, but there's so many people that, that is hard to do, right? Yeah. In interacting with, like, I have learned over the last couple of years how prevalent anxiety is in our yeah. society.
I spend a ton of time talking to people about their anxiety.
Oh my gosh. I've known people to be anxious when I didn't feel like I was being anxious right. or I didn't suffer from that. And after having crashed pretty hard a year or so back, now having a newfound appreciation for this. And then it's like one of those things, like once you've been through it, then now you can see it. Mm. And it's like, holy cow,
huh.
we are a very anxious culture.
And we really are.
I think this is also why the dispensaries are jam packed, but
yeah.
you know, but where I'm going with this is I feel like those, like giving people autonomy, one, having that pressure of feeling like you need to be able to set the direction. I think that puts a lot of leaders on edge and they won't just come forward and say, mm. hey, I'm a good leader doing this, but I'm not really good at that. Right. Like this is why you bring people on your team. But then I think across the board, universal is I have coached leaders who have done everything short of selling their home so that they don't have to confront somebody about mm. a thing that they're not doing.
Yeah. Well, right.
Like it is insane to me how much people will create more work and create more stress, create more anxiety, yeah. create more stuff. So they don't have to hold somebody accountable.
Mm.
And it's just, it's crazy. So, but I want to go back to the Interbrand guy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you talk about the, and I think this is universal too. Is all the leaders who are thinking that the way to solve their problems or the way to innovate, the way that we have to move forward is that everybody has to be in a desk.
yeah. Right?
Because we're, let's be honest, we're not talking about a change up in the you know at work space.
Right.
We're not talking about, hey, everybody's gonna be working in a different way now so that we're always collaborating and we're always bringing our best selves. No, it's come and sit at a different place.
Yeah.
That's all we mean. And then we have yep. meetings. We're still going to have technical issues and all that other kind of bullshit.
You're still going to talk to each other through Slack.
yeah. But here's the thing is, to me, the leaders who are leading like the idiot at Interbrand, when it comes to what do we do with AI, they're not going to know. They don't know. They have zero idea on how to take AI and integrate that into what it is that they do
right.
to have meaningful results. So to me, if I'm on the board of directors of any publicly traded company, and if I'm looking at my leader, my CEO, and that guy's big move, or that woman, that person's big move is returning everybody, getting everybody in butts in seats.
Yeah, it's not.
You guarantee they're not going to have a game plan. They're not going to have any ideas for what to do with AI.
Yeah.
None. That's the litmus test. Mm. And you heard it here first.
He's calling it.
I guarantee it that's they're out of ideas.
Right? I think you're right, because you see, speaking of AI, you see it just like bolted on to like things now. It's just like bloop, and there it is. You get AI now, and it's like,
which is like, no, that's
what is this?
What
is it doing?
And so that's just it. You're gonna get the leaders who see return to work as being essential. They're the type that look for bolt-on solutions to real problems.
Yeah.
And it's only going to be the consequences of that are only going to be accelerated through adoption of AI.
Yeah.
Right.
I have an interesting, I have a hard time getting people to talk to me about this. It's okay if you don't want to, because you may know these people or not, but do you remember, I think they're called Basecamp now, but they were 37 Signals. Do you remember? It was like right over 2019 or something like that. 2020. Mm-hmm. I believe it was when Trump was first elected. They had this big blow up where people were talking about politics and stuff in their company, essentially their company Slack. I know they don't use Slack, but, and then they were like, no more talk about this. You know, we're not going to talk about politics. We're not going to talk about religion or whatever. and like half the company left.
Well, but, I feel like they forced them to.
Okay.
They basically, they from my recollection, they said, this is no longer welcome in this workplace. We're only going to focus on work. Basically, we're going to ignore the wider world and how that's making everybody feel while we're world's on fire. And we're going to ignore the fact that that might be having a negative impact on how people show up to work.
Yeah.
So just suck it up, sit in the seat, make base camp.
Yeah, right.
Make more base camps, and then go home and scream into your pillow.
Yeah.
Right. So mature. And then they said, if you don't want that world,
go somewhere
else. You don't think, then here's the severance package. Yeah. See you later.
Yeah. That's what they did.
That's what they did. And then they continued. You know, the thing that really irritates me, like really pisses me off. And one is like, so I think it was like a month or so ago, like right before Thanksgiving-ish, when it came out that one of the co-founders of 37 Signals had written a string of blog posts kind of elated at all of the quote woke people in technology being let go of their jobs.
Oh, really? I didn't catch that.
Yeah. And
that exposes some stuff.
I think it was University of North Carolina. A director there wrote a blog post about how we are, they reviewed these articles and they looked at it as running counter to the values of their program. Mm. And so they've been using Basecamp since day one and they shut it down.
You're right. What was that, Duke?
Maybe it was Duke. Yeah. It was in North Carolina.
Something like that. You're right. Yeah. I did see that. I didn't read it, but it was like, you know, whatever's not using the program anymore.
Yeah. But going back to your original prompt is, I then saw a pattern of tech bro co-founders.
Yeah.
Right. Kind of finally showing their true colors.
Yep. They're out there, folks.
Yep. And unfortunately, and which is such a shame because they were always kind of like, let's just do no nonsense businessing, keep it to the fundamentals. And then to just show again, like once again, like they, I think it was, whatever his name is, DHH, he stayed in bed for days.
Yeah.
Like when this happened,
didn't do anything.
He didn't get out of bed.
Yeah.
It's like, you're the co-founder. You're supposed to be the leader of this company.
Yeah, I know.
And not only do you not choose to show up and engage with the people that you're throwing under the bus.
Yeah.
But now you're hiding.
Yeah.
You're hiding within your own home.
Yep.
That just shows me that you're not a leader. You're just, you got lucky. You were first at bat at something, but you don't know shit about what it means to be a leader.
I agree with you. And I bring it up and I brought it up before as a fan. Like I was a, like I could show you the sign up date in my Basecamp that I still have, which just because I have 5,000 projects in there and I'm too lazy to like my laziness overwrites my indignation of them now. But I was like one of the first 100 customers of the Basecamp product. It's in the thing.
We Happy Cog had one of our first retreats was at the 37 Signals headquarters. Right.
Yeah, sweet headquarters too.
Yeah. I mean it's a shame. It really pisses me off.
What makes me think of that though is it's like, okay, so they were, I remember at the time they were largely remote, right? They had some people in their office, but they were largely remote. And I even remember thinking like, why the hell do you have such a nice office? You have like two people that work there.
Because Jeff Bezos just gave you $4 million.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah. But
even though you tell people don't take money.
Yeah.
Right. And this is when I think back to like, wait a second. These jerks have been telling people to bootstrap their lives,
don't take
money. They took $4 million from Jeff Bezos.
Yep.
Yep. So like, you know, it's just like, holy shit. Why didn't we just call their bullshit back then?
Yeah, I don't know why we did.
Hats off to those people who did. I didn't even really think about it and spend much time thinking about it.
Yeah, until I know. It's all in retrospect. I know, for real.
Yeah.
But it's like, that can't be the first time that something like that's happened in a company, though. Mm. Like, you know, it's just so funny. It can't be the first time, or even during that time, it can't be the only company that where people were like, stop talking about Trump at work. You know, like, it can't be. You know, it's just so funny that it was... maybe it's because it's us and the world we live in. It was just so such big news.
Well, I think it's in this case it's Trump. In other cases, it's been other things. You know,
yeah.
When I ran LexBlog, the owner of the company, who was like I think he's like 15 years older or so, we would have all hand meetings every Monday morning, and I would give him like the last say. And here's a guy who got his shots, but boy, howdy, is he really pissed off that he's got to wear a mask. And yeah. We were all remote, right? Like we're all remote. Like doesn't matter. Nobody asked him. Like he didn't have to go into an office and wear a mask. Yeah. But he was so pissed off that he had to wear a mask to like when he went to go get a beer. And we found out that there was one employee who didn't get vaccinated.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't tell him who. And it just pissed him off so much that every Monday he would just get on a soapbox and talk about how it's so talk of these anti-vaxxers and, you know, this and that. And the guy actually had a legitimate reason why he hadn't got the shot yet.
Sure. There are people out there.
Yeah. A legitimate reason. Yeah. And, but here's this guy who's just, he's so put out because he's impacted.
Yeah.
Right. And even though, like nobody at that company had anything to do with national trends, but he was taking it out of the company. And it's just, it's no different from these guys saying, hey, enough is enough, right? Mm-hmm. Like, don't talk about this because it's making some other people uncomfortable. And it's like, well, no, that's exactly why you should talk about it.
Right.
So instead of like saying, no, you can't talk about it, do the adult thing, be a leader and create the environment where you can talk about it. Because a lot of times people just need to be heard.
That's right.
They just want to know that their voice is being heard and that they're not going to have to go back into becoming a silent minority or a silent, whatever. It's like, so I think this last round was rattling the cage of a group of people who have been in the majority for so long that they finally got a taste of their own medicine. Mm-hmm. And boy, they didn't know what to do.
Right? Get emotive about it.
No clue what to do.
I bring that stuff up because it's a cultural thing that we're all going through outside of work, right? Like this lack of interpersonal resiliency, like you brought it up. It's like, we're scared to call someone out on something that they should be responsible for. Like we're scared to just have that interaction. We're scared to have that confrontation. That's gotta be something that you have to deal with. I mean, if you're going into a situation where you're going to teach people how to be leaders, you've got to address that stuff.
Yeah, you can't just go down that. If you continue going down the happy path, you're never gonna, be able to graduate and move your tassel over the leadership, graduation ceremony. But I mean, I also think too, you want to really test your leadership skills, fire somebody.
Oof. Yeah.
Because I don't care how many times you've done it. I think I've done it 5 times now. And they've all been for cause. It wasn't because someone was, doing anything malicious or anything, but just like they weren't doing their job.
Yeah.
And I don't care. I've talked to other leaders about this who have had to do this. I don't care how long you've been doing this. It always sucks. Like there's never no easy way to do it. You can prepare statements. You can try to memorize what you're going to say.
Yeah.
And it's just like that, getting punched in the face.
Yeah.
You just got to get through it and you're going to feel like shit. Afterwards, even though it was justified and the right thing to do, those are the things that, just like anything else that happens bad. Yeah. I think it's just that you know ahead of time, right? A lot of times we get caught into reactionary and we have to go do something like fire people or lay people off, right? Yeah. and you know it's coming, that's a hard walk and it doesn't make it necessarily easier, but at least you know kind of how you're going to feel on the other end.
Yeah. Well, Greg, man, I don't think we've solved a single world problem, but it was fun talking to him with you.
It's good talking with you too. It's good to see you.
Yeah, man, for sure. We'll do it again.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Cool, man.